Did you know Moby Dick was inspired by a true story? In 1821, a massive 85-foot sperm whale sunk the whale ship Essex. 20 men went into the water that day, but only 8 men survived to tell the tale. I'm Mel Hill, and this is The Survivors. What is it about our minds that makes human suffering and survival so compelling? Follow along with us every week at The Survivors Podcast on Instagram for pictures and visuals pertaining to each episode. Again, that's at The Survivors Podcast on Instagram. This is the unbelievable true story that inspired Herman Melville's masterpiece, Moby Dick. It's the story of the whale ship Essex, which was famously sunk by a sperm whale in 1820, and the harrowing journey of the men who survived to tell the tale. This story is insane. We're talking starvation, cannibalism, and some of the cruelest irony you can imagine. Before we begin the story, I need to take a moment to describe the horrific nature of the whaling industry in the 1800s. It was brutal. And here's how it all worked. A lookout would spot a sperm whale and shout something like, "There she blows!" Teams of 4 or 5 men would then descend into the whaleboats, which were essentially 20-foot lifeboats. From there, they would row towards their target. Upon encountering the whale, a giant harpoon was thrust into it, physically connecting the whaleboat to the whale. Believe it or not, stabbing a whale usually caused it to freak out, which meant they needed to stab it more and more and more and drive it into a frenzy, making it drag the whaleboat hundreds and hundreds of feet from the ship. This was an extremely violent affair, and especially strange, considering most of the men in this story were Quakers, a famously peaceful denomination. The carcass of the whale was then towed up next to the main vessel, where it was beheaded and then processed using a giant hook, or multiple hooks, to pull the blubber off in huge spirals, much like spiraling an apple, or spiraling a ham, or spiraling a potato, or can you tell I'm hungry? The whole point of this dramatic, dangerous, and violent endeavor was to extract the spermaceti. What's the spermaceti, you ask? Well, in the 1800s, it was an extremely valuable commodity. It was used chiefly in ointments, cosmetic creams, fine wax candles, hair pomades, etc., etc. It was bomb. Basically, lip balm. Everybody wanted it. So, it was valuable. Back to the Essex. Launched in August of 1819 from Nantucket, Massachusetts, Captain George Pollard set sail with a crew of 20 for Cape Horn in South America on a whaling voyage that was to last 2.5 years. So, 2 days in, an insane storm comes out of nowhere and it destroys the ship's top sail. It knocked the entire boat on its side and it was nearly sinking. The ship was eventually able to right itself and completely recover. But of the 5 boats on the ship, 2 were lost at sea and a 3rd was crushed, rendering it unusable. This left only 2 working whaleboats. And that 3rd boat that was crushed, it needed immense repairs. Now, usually a whaling vessel of this size would require a minimum of 3 whaleboats. plus 2 spares. The crew understood this, and they knew they couldn't possibly continue. And Captain Ballard declared that they would need to go back to Nantucket for repairs. Quite frankly, this seems like a smart decision to me because it's only 2 days in. They're really not far from Nantucket. They probably should go back. But unfortunately, First Mate Owen Chase and Second Mate Matthew Joy insisted that they continue on, believing that they could attain more whaleboats along the way. Pause for my own personal opinion here. Why, when you're only 2 days out from your original destination, 2 days out on a 2.5 year journey, and you lose 3 of your 5 whaleboats, would you continue on with the journey as opposed to returning back to your port to then have the efficient and sufficient tools that you need to complete your journey? It's a 2.5 year journey. That is messed up. But whatever, these guys were foolhardy and they convinced Captain Ballard to continue on. So they went on without returning to Nantucket. 5 weeks into their voyage, and luckily after securing an extra whaleboat, the Essex arrived in the waters off southern South America, only to find that the whaling grounds were all dried up. They rounded Cape Horn, cruised up the western coast of Chile, and had little luck finding whales anywhere. They really needed to up the ante. Eventually, off the coast of Peru, the Essex encountered a ship called the Aurora, which also just so happened to be from Nantucket. Captain Ballard spoke with Captain Russell, who headed up the crew of the Aurora, and learned of a newly discovered fertile whaling ground called the Offshore Ground. This was an area near the equator in the Pacific Ocean that was around 1,500 miles west of South America, deep in the Pacific. This was a massive distance for whalers at the time. If any problems should arise on their journey, they would be completely and utterly alone, with nothing but a vast blue horizon from bow to stern. Fortunately, the Essex did eventually reach the offshore ground. There, they ramped up their whaling efforts, but the whales continued to elude them. Then, on the morning of November 20th, 1820, the lookout of the Essex spotted some whales off in the distance, and the chase was on. Now, I want to remind all of you listeners that November 20th, 1820, is over a year since they set out on this journey, and they've caught basically nil when it comes to whales. So after a year and 3 months, these guys are hungry to catch something, right? They want to get home to their families. They need to secure that paycheck. So the Essex sailed within half a mile of this pod that was spotted and lowered 3 whaleboats. Captain Ballard, Owen Chase, and Matthew Joy each took charge of one of the whaleboats. Captain Ballard's boat and Matthew Joy's boat were able to harpoon and attach to a whale. Now, Owen Chase's boat also attached to a whale, but in the ensuing commotion, the whale smashed a hole into their side of their whaleboat, and it forced them to cut the line and return to the main ship. Here's where things took a bit of a turn for the worse. When they got back to the Essex, one of the crew noticed an unusually large sperm whale off of the port bow. They estimated that this whale was about 85 feet long. The Essex itself is 88 feet long. That means this whale was 3 feet shy of the size of this boat. That is a big whale. This enormous whale they spotted dove deep, and then it resurfaced much, much closer to the ship. This was strange behavior for a sperm whale. They usually would swim away in a panic, but this one seemed so unafraid. The creature dove again, deeper this time, and as it rose to the surface, it charged directly at the 88-foot Essex. This humongous ship-sized whale was on a direct collision course with a boat that matched its size. Unable to maneuver the ship out of its path, the crew heard a tremendous crash as the massive whale collided with the side of the boat. Giant wooden timbers smashed in two on the side of this boat, and the entire ship shuddered and shook and knocked every man off of his feet. The whale submerged again, and it rammed the keel, causing even more destruction. Incredibly, the whale struck the ship a third time with a final violent blow to the bow. It was at this point that one of the crew members came up from below deck, shouting that they were taking on water. The Essex was sinking, bow first, and quickly. She was listing dangerously to port, or for those of you who don't know boat lingo, that means to the left. Owen Chase and some of the crew prepared the one remaining whale boat, and they abandoned ship. They watched in horror as the Essex capsized in their small wake. Meanwhile, Captain Pollard and Matthew Joy were still hunting their whales. Remember, they had harpooned their whales, and their whaleboats were attached to them. They glanced up in the direction of the ship, and they saw it laying on its side and immediately cut their lines and returned to it. But it was far too late. Only 10 minutes after the attack began, the Essex was stove. The 20 remaining men were able to extract some food, little water, two compasses, and some other supplies from the wreck. They were even able to add some rudimentary sails to the three small whaleboats. They now had to make a plan. Where do they go from here? To the east was Galapagos, some 2,000 miles away by this point. Much closer to the west was the Marquesas Islands and the Society Islands. They were 1,200 miles away, but these were allegedly home to cannibals, which absolutely terrified the crew, and quite frankly, it terrifies me too. To the northwest was Hawaii, but that was 2,500 miles away. While Captain Pollard wanted to sail west of the Society Islands and risk an encounter with the cannibals, Owen Chase and Matthew Joy preferred heading east, back to South America. And because those guys were total bros, they convinced everybody that they were right, including Captain Pollard, and guess what? They decided to sail back to South America. The logic behind Chase and Joy's choice to sail further to get to land instead of facing cannibals was based on the fact that they were men of the sea, and they spent most of their lives whaling on boats instead of on land, and they felt comfortable in the water. They would rather face the water than potentially be eaten by another human being. Now, due to the prevailing winds, their plan meant first sailing south for 1,500 miles to catch a westerly wind, which would eventually whisk them up to South America. This is an insane distance to think about, especially in a 20-foot whaleboat. They estimated the journey would take about 2 months. They had to make their remaining food and water last 60 days. Unless, of course, they were rescued. For food, they had hardtack. It's kind of a dried bread made of flour and water. They also had a few tortoises that they had purchased from the Galapagos. And they had a few casks of water. So off they went. Day after day and week after week, they pushed on. All three whaleboats intended to stay together so they could help each other if problems were to arise. And this was especially important to Matthew Joy's boat, because his was the only one without an all-important compass. Staying together was an extremely difficult task, especially at night. Owen Chase's boat was not in good shape. The planks were twisted and rotten, and one day a storm blew in, and their boat was flooded, and they frantically bailed water to stay afloat. Some of the hardtack was soaked in the process, and it reduced their food rations, which is an extremely disappointing situation considering they had such limited rations to begin with. Worse still was the fact that their water rations at this point were at half pint per day. A half pint. A half a pint, in case you aren't aware, is one cup of water. and the water rations were so low that a lot of the men resorted to drinking their own urine. The man of the hour, Owen Chase, first mate Owen Chase, later wrote, "Their suffering at this time, quote unquote, almost exceeded human belief. They were deteriorating. Their bodies were literally consuming themselves due to lack of food. Salt sores, pustules were appearing all across their bodies, and their hair began falling out in clumps. And this was just the beginning." After nearly a month of this torture, the men miraculously came upon Henderson Island, a flat, tiny speck of land in the endless ocean. They were ecstatic, but also terrified that the island may be home to cannibals. They had no choice but to make landfall, and they were pleased to find that the island was completely uninhabited. Being in a boat would feel so helpless, adrift, nothing but vast, blue, endless wasteland, and now they have some sort of solid ground under their feet and possibly food to hunt and water to collect. It would have felt incredible. So when the men found this island, they did find water and food. They were so excited, as one might be after being adrift in an ocean for many, many days with little rations and next to no water. Unfortunately, their excitement was short-lived. Only one full week on the island had drained every available resource. No food remained to be found. Henderson Island was fairly desolate to begin with, and these 20 men stripped the entire land and left nothing. And sadly, this is a common and fairly relatable event in the wake of mankind. It was clear the time had come to head back out to sea. Now, if I were one of these men that had spent only 1 week on land after having spent a full month at sea in a 20-foot lifeboat with six other men, I would not want to get back on that boat. And you know what? That was true of three of the men that were a part of the Essex. They could not bring themselves to get back onto the whaling ships, and they decided to stay on this tiny island, marooned, and pray for rescue. So three men shy, the Essex crew in three whaleboats take off to reach Easter Island from Henderson Island, which should only be about a 1,000-mile journey. If they miss Easter Island, which is but a speck in the ocean, then they will have to sail an extra 2,000 miles to Chile in order to reach land. After the men take off for Easter Island, the men are hit with a violent storm, and it blows them farther and farther south. And this created a humongous problem. They're now too far south to reach Easter Island. So they had no choice. They have to sail directly for South America. And as I said before, it was going to be an extra 2,000 miles. Fortunately, all of the men on the whaleboats survived this storm. The unfortunate situation is that their rations were extremely low. The food that they had gathered from Henderson Island and brought along was completely diminished, and they were surviving on only 3 ounces of hardtack per day per man, which is nothing. It's like a couple bites of like solid bread with like grit, and it tastes like garbage. And again, there's no water, and they collected some from the storms, but they were still having to drink their own urine. I mean, ugh. And here's where this story goes from bad to worse. And the true crime junkie in me is really attracted to this part of the story because it gets so messed up and so dark. And I'm not sure what's wrong with me, but I love that about it. And you wouldn't be listening to this if you weren't a little bit into it too. So here we go. The first crew member to die was Matthew Joy, the second mate. And he died on January 10th, 1821. He had fallen ill a few days before. The three boats came together and they did what they could to celebrate Joy before delivering him to the depths of the sea. It was 51 days since the Essex had sunk. The next day and night brought more storms and high winds. Owen Chase's boat was in the lead, and by the next morning, to their dismay, neither of the other two boats could be seen. Unsure if they had sunk or merely separated, Chase had no choice but to continue. This was devastating to the crew. Now they were completely alone. Unbeknownst to Chase, the other two boats were still afloat and sailing together. They were equally affected by the separation, but also had no choice but to press on. Food was becoming a huge issue. Food rations on Joy's boat, now captained by a man named Obed Hendricks, were completely gone. Pollard shared what he could, but the reality was that in a few days, no food would remain, despite being on tiny rations. Storms gave way to maddening calms. With no wind, there was nothing the men could do but wait. Every second was an hour. The hunger pangs, the relentless sun, the endless thirst, they were breaking them down. Richard Peterson was the next to die. He was on Owen Chase's boat. It was January 20th, 2 months since the sinking. He refused his rations that day and joined Matthew Joy at the bottom of the sea. Good for that guy, refusing his rations because he knew he was going to die. That takes a man of heart. That's courage. Lawson Thomas also died that day. He was on Hendrick's boat, which was still sailing with Pollard. It was at this time that the remaining crew began the inevitable discussion they all dreaded. They were starving to death. Their bodies were consuming themselves. They were skin and bones. All they could think about was food. Their crew was dying. So they started the inevitable discussion. Instead of tossing the bodies overboard, should they eat them? It's a horrific idea. But cannibalism at the time was actually not that uncommon among famished sailors. And I mean, if you can imagine being shipwrecked and you had nothing to eat except your deceased counterparts, what would you do? I don't know what I would do. I like to think I wouldn't eat a human, but I don't know. Do you? Because there were no other options, Pollard and Hendricks and the remaining men decided it was time. They had to eat one of their crew because then the rest could live. Okay, so the irony here is not lost on me. And I'm sure that the irony is not lost on you because you're listening to this podcast. These men chose to sail 3,000 miles out of their way to avoid an island with cannibals, to only then become cannibals themselves 60 days later. Truly ironic and very sad, and it really only gets worse, I mean, or better from there if you're me. All right, so here we go. After butchering the body of their friend, the men made a small fire on a stone on the bottom of the boat and they roasted all the organs. And then they feasted on Mr. Lawson Thomas. And 2 days later, the ritual was performed again after the death of Charles Shorter. Meanwhile, on Owen Chase's boat, his crew had been diminished to just 4 men, including Chase. In contrast, these men had decided to not eat their dead comrades. And as a result, they were so weak, they could hardly sail the boat. Back on Hendrick's boat, Isaiah Shepherd died and was eaten. And then Samuel Reed from Pollard's boat met the same fate. It also needs to be mentioned here that all of the sailors that were eaten thus far were black men. And I think that this is a really important point because this is the 1800s. So only one black sailor at this point, William Bond, remained on the boats. Now, it's been suggested that since at this time in history, the black sailors would have had lower level jobs on the ship than the white sailors and probably received less nutritious rations than their normal sailing operations. They were therefore at a significant disadvantage from the beginning. And Bond, the remaining black man, was actually a captain steward, meaning he was afforded a much more comfortable existence on the Essex. But it can't be ignored that there could have been something much more sinister happening, whether it be refusing to share the rations or straight up murder. After all, the white sailors were indeed Nantucketers and Quakers, a closely knit community going back generations. It's likely that they would do whatever it took to ensure their own survival. On the night of January 29th, 69 days after the sinking, Pollard's boat and Hendrick's boat became separated. This was bad news for Hendrick, especially considering he didn't have a compass, and he was 1,500 miles from the nearest land. Amazingly, this story gets even worse. I mean, if it could. Maybe it's equally bad. Only four men remained on Pollard's boat. Our captain, the man who manned the Essex, he was in charge of the Essex. Some may argue that he was perhaps weak. I, too, agree he may have had a weak constitution because he was easily swayed by his first mate and second mate. But that aside, Captain Pollard remained with three other men, his first cousin, Owen Coffin, 16-year-old Charles Ramsdell, and 19-year-old Barzilay Ray. These men were starving, and even eating their crew members that had, quote-unquote, died naturally, they were still starving to death. It was 16-year-old Charles who suggested that they draw lots to determine who they should kill and eat, so the remaining three could survive for a few more days. Pollard didn't like this idea at the time, especially considering his first cousin was on board, but the three others supported the plan, and once again, Pollard, in his weak constitution, his mind was changed, and so they drew lots. Pollard's mind was changed by a 16-year-old boy's idea. This man was not fit to captain a ship. If it was so disturbing to him that his cousin could have been killed, he should have volunteered himself to be the sacrifice in place of his cousin before lots were drawn. But we'll see what happens. The men had scrapped pieces of paper and they put them in a hat. And wouldn't you know it, it was Captain Pollard's cousin, Owen Coffin, whose name was drawn. And then, oh, Pollard's the hero. He's going to sacrifice himself. He offers. And, you know, Owen, he's a real man. And he's like, you know what? No, I drew this slip of paper. I agreed to this. I'm going to sacrifice myself. No problem. So now the question is, who's going to kill him? Who is going to be responsible for taking this man's life so the other three may survive? Wouldn't you know it? But 16-year-old Ramsdell draws the short straw, and he has to be responsible for killing Owen. After a moment of silence and a message to his mother, Coffin was killed and later eaten by the remaining three crew members. By February 6th, 1821, Owen Chase, our hero, and his crew were barely alive. Hardly any hardtack remained. They dreamt of food constantly, imagining indulgent meals they would probably never eat. 2 days later, after ranting incoherently and going into convulsions, Isaac Cole died. Laying next to Cole's dead body that night, Owen Chase came to the same conclusion as Captain Pollard. If the three remaining men had any chance of surviving, they must eat Cole. Decision made, Cole's heart was devoured before a fire could even be lit. His flesh cut into strips, some of it cooked and some of it laid out to dry in the sun like strips of bacon. On February 11th, Barzilay Ray died and was consumed in Pollard's boat. This left only Captain Pollard and Ramsdell and the bones of their fallen comrades. By February 18th, only two crew remained with Owen Chase. They were within 300 miles of Masafuera and Juan Fernandez Island. They were so close, but they were in so much pain and such despair that they had all but given up hope. One of the crew, Nickerson, only 15 years old, had told them the day before that he wished to die immediately. Had they come this far just to perish within a few days of land? And then they saw a sail. With a burst of adrenaline, the three men sailed for their lives towards the ship, and hours went by, hours and hours went by, and they could see that they were gaining on her. And finally, incredibly, somebody on the deck of that boat spotted them, and it was the Indian, a merchant ship from London. They were going to survive. 300 miles south, the only two that remained on Captain Pollard's boat were himself and Ramsdell. They forged ahead. It had been 89 days since the Essex had sunk. They had no food, unless you, of course, counted if one of them died. They chewed on the bones of their dead crew, sucking out the marrow. I love the visceral reaction I have when I think of these men sucking the marrow out of their human comrades' bones. It's so messed up. Like, wow, this happened. They were barely conscious. They were delusional. And they were hardly able to move, but they floated. They floated onward. On February 23rd, 1821, 94 days since leaving the Essex, as they lay in their whaleboat, waiting for their demise, they hear voices. They hear sails fluttering in the wind. And then they see faces. And then all of a sudden, they're found by an American ship called the Dauphin. Pollard and Ramsdell were far too weak to celebrate. They were so messed up that they started filling their pockets with the bones of their fallen comrades, the same bones that they had been sucking marrow from. The crew of the Dauphin carried the men aboard. Pollard and Ramsdell were going to survive. Of the 21 men that set sail on the Essex, only 5 men survived. And all 5 survivors were reunited in Valparaiso. Many of them wrote about the horrific experience. The men were mostly forgiven for their cannibalism. People understood that they really had no other choice. But it wasn't so simple for Pollard. He had actually eaten his first cousin, Owen Coffin. And Coffin's mother never forgave Pollard. And honestly, like, I don't blame her. I think Captain Pollard should have gone down with the Essex, because that's what a true admirable captain would do. So I suppose all's well that ends well, right? But you're probably asking yourself, what happened to those 3 guys that decided not to get back on those 20-foot whaleboats? What happened to those guys? Those guys made the right choice. They were rescued by an Australian ship. and they had survived months on that desolate island. Years later, a whaleboat containing three skeletons was found on Dulce Island, which is presumed to be the three men that were still on the lifeboat that was manned by Hendrix, the one that was separated without a compass. Incredibly, Captain Pollard was entrusted with yet another whaling vessel, which also sank when it ran aground. He survived once again. Although this time rescue came much sooner. This ended Pollard's career as a captain, and he spent the rest of his days in relative obscurity as a night watchman in Nantucket. The ethical and moral issues that arise from this story are deep and plentiful. These men did unspeakable things to ensure their own survival. But can we blame them? Would you not do the same thing if your own life depended on it? There's really only one way to know for sure, and hopefully you'll never have to find out. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Survivors, a Hills Have Ears original podcast. Tune in next week and every week for more harrowing tales of those who have faced death and survived to tell.